Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and we are about to have a conversation with John Harwood, who's co-author with Gerald Seib of the book Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, published by Random House in paperback this year. And on Sunday, August the 2nd, he authored an article in the Week in Review in the New York Times called The Lobbying Web. By putting healthcare in the hands of Congress, Obama may have given an edge to special interests. And John Harwood, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, I was really fascinated by this. I think that we often talk about this healthcare battle, and it gets in most of the media kind of a cursory look about the power of lobbies and lobbying in the process, which you kind of laid out very clearly in what I was a very kind of objective article. You talked a minute about the power of lobbying in this healthcare debate and the effect it's having.
Well, anytime you have an issue, Mark, that is highly complex, that affects everybody, that is a life and death issue, a dollars and cents issue, you're guaranteed to have something that's difficult for politicians to deal with. And the more that affected interests pour it on in terms of flooding the zone with lobbyists, with television ads, with other forms of communication, the more complex and difficult it's going to be. And that's exactly what Barack Obama's finding out right now.
Do you think that, when you write about Barack Obama not having lobbyists in the White House because the rules he passed himself doesn't stop lobbyists from lobbying Congress and going from Congress becoming lobbyists, that he was naive in this regard to think about the power of lobbies in Washington? It's hard to believe that.
I don't see it quite as being naive. I think he got himself in a campaign stance of defining himself as an outsider, contrasting himself with Hillary Clinton as a creature of Washington, somebody who'd been around town for a long time through her husband's presidency and afterwards in the U.S. Senate. And I think he felt a need to identify some policies that would differentiate him. And so one of the things he did was try to draw a line on being the person who would stand up to special interests. The problem is that special interests aren't going anywhere, and you can't really silence affected industries and corporations from trying to make their case. And not that he was trying to silence them, but he was trying to sort of blow past their power and influence. And they've got a lot of influence, especially with members of Congress who need to raise money, who have big hospitals and medical institutions in their districts that have a lot of weight and influence. And so it's just a very, very tough thing he's taken on. There's a reason why comprehensive health care reform has failed for the last 70 years while presidents have tried to make it happen. It's not easy.
It's not easy. And even the pharmaceutical and insurance industries who are lobbying, which we'll talk about, what you talked about in your article, against some of the parts of President Obama's package and what Congress, House representatives are pushing. At the same time, they're at least talking about the need for reform. And everybody, this time, the difference between the two debates is that people are actually saying something has to be done. The question is what?
Exactly. And one of the positive notes and signs for Obama is that the discontent with the status quo has grown so much since Bill Clinton tried and failed, that healthcare inflation has continued unabated so long, that many important parts of industry, in fact, do want reform. It's just they want reform on their terms. Mm-hmm. Everybody is trying to both say, yes, we have to fix healthcare, as the new ads from the health insurance lobby states. On the other hand, they don't want to fix it in a way that puts them out of business. So you see the insurance industry pushing very hard against the so-called public option. You see the drug makers pushing very hard against the use of price comparisons in the so-called comparative effectiveness research designed to sort out what it makes sense financially and medically and what doesn't. And everybody is trying to shape it for their interest. The doctors have embraced the House health care bill, but they also want to make sure that there's nothing in the health care bill that causes their reimbursements to go down too much. So it's a challenge.
Well, but it's the power of the lobbying industry, which you have talked about a lot in your book with Gerald Seib, that I've only now read a little bit of, but I'm looking forward to finishing it, maybe having you back on to talk more about that. That it's the power of those lobbyists because of the money they give to members of Congress, because of the relationships they have, which are in the back room, as you write, which is where the real deals are made. I mean, this is what could transform the bill, along with the power to kind of convince Americans that you don't really want what you think you want.
Exactly. And one of the things that we've seen, even in the Obama administration, which has been calling from the beginning of the campaign for more transparency in Washington, they've done a lot of private negotiating with major healthcare industry groups to try to get them on board and keep them on board. So-called savings deals, which they cut with the hospitals and the drug companies around the Medicare prescription drug donut hole, as it's known, those involve a complex series of trade-offs where the administration's trying to find the space and the dollars to do enough reform that people will recognize it, but also not so much that it repels those people who have the money to have a megaphone in this country and make their voices heard.
So when you write in your article that the pharmaceutical industry spent $68 million in the second quarter lobbying to extend their patent protection, as you write, for biological drugs beyond the levels favored by some reform advocates, and then you write that, and to limit the use of price comparisons as well in studies, I mean, that's a pretty formidable force.
There's no question about it. And at the same time they've been doing both those things, they've been running advertisements with the a liberal group, Families USA, which is for universal coverage, that features the same actors who played Harry and Louise in those famous ads that helped to take down the Clinton plan in 1993 and 94. So there's a good cop, bad cop routine going on in which the interests say, yes, we want reform, but they're trying to make sure that it doesn't hurt them too much. And they've had some success. They got agreements in the legislation so far on biologic drugs to their liking. We talked about comparative effectiveness. That's another area where they've had some impact. One of the showdowns may come when people in the House are insisting on the right of the government to negotiate lower drugs, and the pharmaceutical industry draws a line on that and calls that government price setting. So there are some battles yet to be fought, and so in some ways the lobbying's only just begun.
And that's interesting bedfellows for these new Harry and Louise. what's the derivation of that? How do both sides square that?
Mark, that shaped the beginning of this debate was the sweeping victory that Barack Obama won. The clear mandate for change that he had caused a lot of people at the beginning of the year to say, you know what, something's going to happen here. You better jump on this train or the train's going to run over you. And so that's what produced this kind of nuanced arrangement where the drug makers, for example, were throwing in with the liberal groups on their advertising, but lobbying to protect the well-being of their industry as they see it. That could be changing now. There's certainly less cockiness, confidence among Democrats that they are, in fact, going to do this. And so that could change the dynamic by which some of these interest groups have said, we got to jump on the train. If they start jumping off the train, then the battle could get even more intense. And one sign of that is the way the White House and Democrats, in particular in the House, have been going after the insurance companies lately. Nancy Pelosi said the other day that they were immoral, that they were villains for
right.
how they had been handling this. And that tells you that the tentative truce or coalition that had been amassed while Barack Obama was at the apex of his power may be shifting.
So you could see a kind of a weird kind of schism, maybe even the lobbying end of the world, where if the pharmaceuticals can come to a compromise, spend their $68 million somewhere, and the health insurers might lose out on some, be on the other side opposing this?
Yes, and one of the fascinating things that I talked to Howard Pastor, who was the chief White House lobbyist for Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton tried and failed to get health care reform. And he was talking about this dynamic of you know, it the equation works one way when there's a general expectation of success in the legislation, and when that starts to lose altitude, then the dynamics change. And he said, you very well could see the Democrats in the White House and on Capitol Hill lobby the lobbyists to try to get them to stay on board to preserve this notion that it's not just liberal Democrats acting, it's liberal Democrats plus key segments of American business or the healthcare industry. That will be a fascinating and delicious irony if that actually materializes.
That's fascinating, man. But you, so I wonder what the dynamic is here politically. Do you think shaping, if it's any different in Washington now than it's ever been? Because you talk about the Annenberg Public Policy Center holding last week a survey, a focus group among independent voters right here in Towson, Maryland, which is right near where, not far from our studios, but 15 minutes away. And it's a mixed but mostly white suburban area. And you quote a rental agent in there, Remy Brook, and Louis Marcioni, who's a graphic designer, both of whom voted for President Obama, and both of whom seem to label the special interests as either organized crime or feeling that we're at the mercy of power groups, mm-hmm. lobbyists, and financiers. So that seems to be, in a lot of ways, whether you're on the right or the left or in the middle, an overwhelming populist sentiment in America.
There is. And that's one of the reasons why you saw the rhetoric that you heard from Nancy Pelosi about the insurance companies. Those same people in that focus group, by the way, even as they've seen Barack Obama take a few hits, politically speaking, they still have a fairly deep level of personal connection and confidence in him.
Mm-hmm.
But public opinion on healthcare is very, very multi-layered and nuanced. And at different points, different sides of the argument can find resonant chords. It's just that the sentiment is for changing the system in any specific way is always going to be more diffuse than kind of the anxiety that's out there about what exists today. And so the challenge for the administration is to achieve a focus and a consistent message about some specific changes that people can relate to and get behind. Because right now it's sort of sprawling and all over the place, multiple bills moving in the Congress, and it's shaping up to be a pretty hot August for those members of Congress going back to town meetings in their district.
So I wonder then if part of the problem is, A, it's a sprawling nature, and that when early on President Obama and others were talking about Reagan, Ronald Reagan, our former mm-hmm. president, being kind of a role model on some levels, and one of the things he did so well as president was to be able to go over the heads of Congress and appeal to the kind of visceral emotions of people in America to get his way.
He did, although I will say that in the major most difficult economic agenda item that he passed, the keystone of that was tax cuts. And tax cuts just tends to ring a little better in people's ears as a message than complex health policy changes. It seems to me the closer analog to Reagan was when he got through the tax reform bill in his second term in 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was also an issue. Affects everybody. Not quite the same emotional oomph to taxes as there is to health care, but it's very complicated. And he ultimately came upon along with Bob Packwood and Dan Rostenkowski, the key members of Congress on this, a clean argument to say, we're going to take away a bunch of loopholes and deductions, but we're going to lower your rates, and you're going to like that simpler system. And people did for a while, although over time it's gotten a little bit less simple as people have added amendments to it.
And just for our listeners who aren't that old or don't know that history, that Packwood was a senator and a liberal Republican from Oregon, and Rostenkowski, of course, was a political powerhouse on the Democratic side from Chicago in the House of Representatives that came together with Reagan to do this.
Exactly. And there you had a genuine bipartisan compromise because Republican President Reagan, Republican-controlled Senate, which is why Bob Packwood was the chairman of the Finance Committee, but Democrats still strongly in control of the House of Representatives, and Danny Rostenkowski, an old-school Chicago Democratic Paul, got in a room and cut that deal with Bob Packwood, and they all went down to the White House and got it signed into law.
I know that you talked about this bill as being wide-ranging, and I'm going to come back here in a moment just to conclude to talk about the power of lobbying and where this might end up with what you wrote about in the Sunday Times. But I'm also kind of surprised, though I'm not sure what it would be, that President Obama and his staff haven't come up with kind of a simpler overarching view that kind of can move America, especially giving its visceral response to all the power of lobbying.
Well, one of the difficulties has arisen from the fact that learning the lesson, as they see it, of Clinton's mistakes in the 90s, rather than come up with a detailed piece of legislation that they're then going to try to sell to Congress, President Obama and his aides have let committees of Congress assemble bills that they believe match his principles. That blurs the picture because you've got three different committees working in the House and you've got a couple of different committees working in the Senate, and each has different processes and different products. That makes it more difficult. And so ultimately, the president is going to have to make some tough calls, as the both chambers of commerce are, and then focus around a message. And you've seen the White House message shift a little bit. There was cost control for a time. Most recently, they're talking about consumer protections, and in particular, protecting Americans against what they see as the overreach of insurance companies and making decisions to deny coverage in certain circumstances. So that is an evolving message, and the test of August is going to be how effectively Democrats can sell it.
And that's part of what you talk about that's going on right now in this month of August in everybody's home districts, with lobbying interests on one side and groups like Healthcare for America Now and others who are battling district by district with voters and with the elected officials.
Yes, and in this case, the liberal groups who are with Obama have got a lot of wind at their backs. And, you know, the fundamental advantage Obama has is the country has shifted in the direction of wanting somewhat more government assistance in the economy and in securing and stabilizing their own futures, because the economic times have been so turbulent. Even with the reaction to spending and deficit spending, as we've seen, this is not the conservative moment of anti-government. It's something that is far different from that. So that's an advantage that they have, and the liberal groups have money. They've got organizers on the ground. The Obama team, of course, was extremely effective at using social networks and actual field organizers as opposed to just television ads. And so all of those are tools at the disposal of the administration, the Democratic Party, and they're going to be using them.
So do you think that, as you talk about in your article, Richard Kirsch, who directs the group Healthcare for America Now, which is a liberal healthcare lobbying group, and you have him quoted as saying that health industry players are going to try to, quote, thread the needle to reform past that protects their profits, end quote. If that ends up, where are we? And what do you think about us ending up there?
Well, I guess one of the questions that members of Congress and voters are going to have to decide is there room for both events? That is to say, can you have a successful reform that protects the profits of private insurers? Some Democrats, of course, say no. They want a government-run system. They want a single-payer system, and they see the public option as a step to that. On the other hand, it is certainly possible to envision the persistence of a private insurance industry in a system with many more people insured, which means the insurance companies get more customers, but you also have more regulation that causes them to not deny coverage for pre-existing conditions and cover more things. All of that is in the back and forth of the negotiating, with the considerations being what Americans want and expect from their doctors, with also the imperative to control costs. And it's why it's terribly complicated. It's why I'm glad I get to write about it and talk about it and don't have to vote upon it in Congress.
Well, that's a great way to conclude this conversation, because I think we're both lucky in that regard, but I think it's an important one for us to cover, which we will. And this has been a very illuminating article that you've written, John Harwood, and I do appreciate your work, and I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Mark, thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. John Harwood has been our guest. He's co-authored the book with Gerald Tsai, Pennsylvania Avenue, Profiles in Backroom Power, published by Random House in paperback this year, and wrote the article that you can link to on our website, The Lobbying Web, that appeared in the Week in Review. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Abir. A very interesting woman lives in Baltimore, but who's a Palestinian hip-hop artist. We'll find out how those things connect in just a minute. We'll be right back.
The Israeli resistance, to soldiers who refuse to use tanks to fight children. May Elohim give power to Jewish people, those supporting anti-Zionism and fight for freedom. It's such a blessing to know there are some who came to learn that hate and racism causes
war. That is a cut from Abir's album, her CD, Sabrina DeWitch, which is Intifada, mixtape volume 1. And Abir is in the studio. I met Abir because of a documentary made called Slingshot Hip Hop about Palestinian hip hop that was given to me by her mother-in-law, a woman named Libby Baker. And Abir, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
So tell us a bit about your story, because what's interesting to me is when I saw this documentary, Slingshot Hip Hop, it was about a Palestinian group in, as you say in Hebrew, Lod, or as you say in Arabic, it's
Lid
in Israel. And it was about Palestinian Israelis forming a hip-hop group, and then it talked about groups in the West Bank and groups in Gaza of young Palestinians also working on hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And then there you were.
Right.
In this movie as a young hip-hop artist in Israel. Mm-hmm. So talk about just, I'm very interested about who you are, where you came from, and how this world of hip-hop came to you as a young Palestinian Israeli.
I'm a Palestinian hip-hop artist, and I was born inside the Israeli borders, meaning I am a Palestinian from a Palestinian family, but I have an Israeli ID. And I really grew up most of my life in Israel thinking that I'm just an Arab, so like as if it's type of an Israeli to be an Arab person.
Mm-hmm.
But somewhere along my teenage years, I started hearing the word Palestinian a lot. And in 2000, I was still in high school, and the second Intifada started. The first Intifada started in 82, and the second one started in 2000. And
in the occupied territories in the West Bank, not in...
Right, but the one in 2000, this is what happened, the change that happened that made me and many other Palestinians living in Israel to realize that, wait, maybe we're not fully Israelis, maybe we're not Israelis at all, is that when the second Intifada started in the West Bank, somehow it got into the Israeli territories, and Palestinians instead of Israel started resisting too, and 13 young men were shot in those incidents. And
in Israel proper?
Yes, by Israeli soldiers. And it was a bit hard for us as young people to realize 13 citizens were killed by the government.
Killed?
Why?
Not just shot, but killed.
Definitely. Because what we've learned that these young people went to, whether were protesting against the Israeli militants in the Palestinian territories and everything they do there, or not, or just some of them were killed randomly in sitting with their friends. So when someone is not even protesting and they're shot by police forces, it's killing. It's they weren't doing anything to be shot from the beginning. And all of them were Palestinians. And it started jumping in my head. What is it to be a Palestinian? What does that mean? How come I've never heard of this before? Why is this so new and so weird? And it doesn't feel good to be in Israel, mm-hmm. knowing you're a Palestinian. And then you find out, what is the West Bank? Even though we live there, and I've been to Ramallah many times growing up, it all made sense, because that's the way we thought it's supposed to be, that there are places that you have to go through checkpoints to get to them. It just was part of our lives, and since nobody talks about it, fearing, you know, the Israeli government, parents want their kids not to be talking political issues. So I was never really exposed to any real information about my Palestinian identity and what is this conflict that Israel has with the Palestinians that I'm part of. And how am I here? How am I here instead of Israel? And who are these people in the West Bank? And then you learn about the refugees, and then you learn about 48, and you realize that your existence is so much more than you were told. And then I met hip-hop.
Then you met hip-hop?
Yes.
How did you meet hip-hop?
Because I had an identity all of a sudden. There was finally some, I could say my name is Abir and I'm this and that. Before that, I was just an Arab, and it was like, but this is my language. I'm Muslim, but this is my religion. It's not really what I am. I couldn't identify fully as an Arab or as a Muslim. And Palestinian meant a lot more to me. Not because my family is Palestinian and I have Palestinian roots, and I'm very, very connected to the Palestinian struggle, and I choose to be on the side of the oppressed people because, you know, it's not a fair, even conflict, and I'd rather be with those who are being oppressed and being pushed by power and imperialism. And I loved the identity of a Palestinian because I always wanted to be a truthful artist and a fighter, and to be attached to my humanity and the human that I am, and find things in common with other people from different places, speaking different languages. Mm-hmm. But Israel was everything against that. So I could not find myself as an Israeli. And seeing those incidents and this violence against Palestinian people made me realize I'd rather be fighting with those oppressed and not calling myself an Israeli because it's comfortable and I'm living in Israel. And hip-hop is all about identity. It's basically a person speaking their thoughts and their beliefs and their ideologies in rhymes and on beats and just saying it out loud. And it's okay to be mad in hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very angry. So it made a lot of sense because I found out I was a woman too, which adds a lot to the whole situation. To be a Palestinian and to be a woman, meaning I have to fight with Zionist Arabs around me, and then I have to fight with Zionist Israelis.
Zionist Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
To me, a Zionist person is someone who will justify his actions that could be very, very, that could be full with injustice and brutality and violence, in order to achieve something that belongs to you, that you have ownership over. This is my land, I want to take it, and I'm going to take it in any way. This is my family, and I'm going to have control over it in any way. This is what Zionism means to me. That.
So you see that word Zionist as a pejorative word?
Definitely. It's not a new term. It's not something that Jewish people invented or something. It's just now that we're very connected with the Israelis because they started this term. It was a term that they took to a level we've learned that. This is the funniest thing, part two, because we've learned about Zionism in school, but not about Palestine. We've learned about how...
You mean in your schools in Israel growing
yes,
up?
Yes, going to an Arab high school instead of Israel, we were taught a lot about Zionism and how amazing it is and how great it is to have a dream, to go back to your land. And they didn't mention all the people that lived already. And I was in a Palestinian school, in an Arab school. Then you'll realize everything is run by the government. It doesn't really matter. But it was very absurd that we were not even taught we're Palestinians. We were not even taught that our families were here before the Zionist dreamers came to this country to claim that it's their own. And Zionism exists in families, it exists in relationships, it exists in societies. And
I think I'm fascinated by that, because growing up the way I grew up, of course, Zionism, you look at that as when I first learned of it as a child, as a ideology of liberation.
Right.
From oppression in Europe.
Right.
To go to this place called Palestine and turn it into Israel. And then for you, this mm-hmm. word, growing up now, is a pejorative word that you find synonymous with your oppression.
Right.
Right?
Definitely.
Right.
It's the best word to use to describe what I'm fighting against.
So that's interesting. So no, it is very interesting. And that growing up in Israel, for you as a young woman, mm-hmm. schools were segregated as they were in America in the 50s and 60s legally. Arabs went to one school, Jewish kids go to another school.
Correct.
Was that the law, that kids cannot go to school together?
Well, yeah, but I, for some reason, my parents sent me to a Jewish kindergarten when I was very young. Before I went to a Muslim public school, to elementary school, I spent all my childhood years being in a Jewish kindergarten. So that world was part of mine, but that's why it was very confusing to grow up there, especially when your parents want to be progressive and send you to alone. I was the only Arab kid. Maybe
really?
There was one or two. Yeah, it wasn't acceptable that Arab kids will be, you know, going to school with Jewish kids.
And how'd they get you in there?
I have no idea. I don't know, but I know that me and my sisters before me were all sent to Jewish kindergartens. And
so you're the baby of the family?
No, I'm third out of seven.
Third out of seven. Okay, I was just kidding. When you said it, sisters being older, I was curious.
Right.
So, you also went to Tel Aviv University,
mm-hmm.
right? Tel Aviv University, and to the artist photographic
Bezalel
Academy
mm-hmm.
to study photography.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you described how your friendships kind of crossed these national lines.
Right. You meet, well, most of the Israeli students I went to school with in Tel Aviv University and in Jerusalem, most of them went to the army. So that was the first difference between us after, you know, language and religion and lifestyle. We were both citizens, both had the Israeli IDs, but they went to the army and served against my people when I didn't. And that for itself, it creates a huge gap between Israeli students and Palestinian students in these institutions, because naturally the Israeli students are going to be put in priority and everyone else is beneath them, whether it's including Russians and Ethiopians and you know, other Jewish people that are not from European countries and are not white. That thing definitely exists in Israel too. There is a huge ladder of different citizenship, and we are not, Arabs are not considered to be one of the top ones. So it created a huge gap, and there were always arguments about why I don't identify myself as an Israeli, why I have so many issues with Israel and the Jewish state. And it seemed like those students who went to the army and went to these places and shot people among their, you know, many services and were on checkpoints and they stopped people and get them off, you know, taxis in their cars and searched them and investigated them. And yet they couldn't understand why I couldn't identify myself as an Israeli. It was very, very hard for people to understand that. How are you going to an Israeli university, but you're calling yourself a Palestinian?
I noticed on your website that, and by the way, folks, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Abir, who is a Palestinian hip-hop artist. I found her in this documentary film we'll be talking about next month called Slingshot Hip-Hop, about the Palestinian hip-hop movement. She has her own CD out called Sabrina DeWitch, which we'll talk about in a minute again, which is Intifada, Mixtape Volume 1. And she joins us here in our studios. And she lives now in Baltimore, which I find also very interesting. This, who unearth themselves in a city like ours all over the place are interesting people like this that pop up. So you also grew up in the time when, even in cities like Lod or Haifa or Akko, where a lot of Akra, mm-hmm. Akko, where mm-hmm. a lot of Palestinians live,
mm-hmm.
there was also in that period of time a lot of bombings going on from the Palestinian side, kind of in the suicide bombings. And in the interviews I've done over the years, many Palestinians I talked to found that as abhorrent as they did the occupation. I'm curious how that affected you as well.
Well, growing up, we were there were many confusing days where you have no idea which side you're on.
Mm-hmm.
And because as a child, you don't understand all the complicity of politics,
right,
and you have no idea who's who. And at that point, you basically respond as a human being. Whoever was hurt, you're with them. That's how you feel. That's how your what your heart tell you to do. And because, you know, as a normal human being, you're scared of violence. It's not something that you laugh about or smile about or celebrate. So whenever something happened, whether in Tel Aviv or in other cities, as a child, I was very confused and hurt for both sides. That was a time where I was, my feelings were equally confused for to the both sides because I didn't want my Arabs to be called these names, terrorists, and you know they're destroying the world, and it hurts for a child to be told you're coming from a place that is savage, and this is the kind of stuff we used to hear from Israeli people as children. And on the other side, you want to fit in the community you live in. And people died on that side. And if you say or think, even in your head, that it was okay for any reason, especially when you don't understand at all what are the reasons, you don't go there. As a child, I didn't let myself explore too much. I just said what I felt. And questioning these type of issues was not really easy, again, because the parents were always very worried for their children's safety.
Well, you could have been blown up as easy as an Israeli Jewish person on a bus or anywhere else. Bus on a street corner, walking home.
Right. There are a lot of protection wrapped around you from everybody who knows you. So it wasn't easy. But as a teenager and as an adult, the confusion started becoming anger because I fully and truly believed all these events could have been avoided. They could have been stopped. They could have been there. I fully started not trusting people around and what they say. And the news, you start developing a relationship with the media by not believing everything said and hearing, realizing what people around you are saying themselves, listening to individual opinions, where hopefully someone along the way will tell you the truth, which is not easy to hear when you're talking about the Israeli and the Palestinian conflict, because everybody's going to say it's our land. This is what we want. This is what, and we're going to do anything to get it, basically. And this is as much as I knew then.
Mm-hmm.
Being an adult in universities, there weren't as many suicide bombings. So, but I already also made a choice about who I am and who I would like to be and what kind of things I would love to support. So I developed a new attitude to anything coming from the Palestinian side.
An attitude that was more open to
Understanding what's going on and what makes someone want to take such a extreme action, an action that might not help. I did not believe that any of these things helped anything, but there was a lot of questions raised after that. There were many questions raised. If you go into a classroom where there are Arabs and Israeli students, before and after something like that happened, you would see how different the truth will show. People's true colors appear after these kind of incidents. People who always tell you, "Oh, we need peace, we need to fight for peace," from the Israeli side, all of a sudden don't like you and they don't want to talk to you. And of course I'm going to develop a relationship with where it's coming from the Palestinian side, because the Israeli side blocked itself fully, and it's okay for a Palestinian to say yes, both sides need to calm down, but the Israeli side say it's Palestinian problem, and this is something I cannot relate to when you.
So in comes hip hop, because what you just the last sentence you just said, in America you hear often that. And you, in here in the black community as well, but you hear often that what's happening in the streets of America is a black problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an American problem.
Right.
What's happening with the Palestinians is a Palestinian problem. It's not, for want of a better term, an Israeli-Palestinian problem. You know, that's not sure what that national identity, if it even exists, is that combines the two. But so in comes hip hop, and hip hop, in many ways, we talked about it earlier before we went in this studio, that hip hop is a cultural expression of frustration and rage that came out of the Bronx and the African American world, that taken over the inner cities of America as a cultural art form, but has also become a cultural art form that has spoken to, seems to have spoken to young people and people out of oppressed cultures throughout the globe.
Right.
Including your Palestinian world.
Right. Because it's very similar. If you try to study hip hop and where it's where it came from and how the whole thing is connected to earth and rights and freedom and, you know what I mean, and equality, most important. And our situation, as especially for me as a Palestinian in Israel, it's very similar to being a black person in the United States. You are not, again, you're not a regular citizen. You're being given, it's a, like somebody's doing you a favor that you're a citizen here. Black people are supposed to be scared, like you're supposed to be scared of. If you're a white person, you would not necessarily like to live in a ghetto. It doesn't make sense. The ghetto and the poor areas make more sense when it's dark people living there. It makes more sense, you know what I mean? It makes more sense when white people have the bigger jobs and black people are the employees. It makes, to people living here, it makes sense. That's how it's supposed to be. And that's how it was to grow up as a Palestinian in Israel. Our neighborhoods were not as clean, as nice, and many neighborhoods don't even have mailboxes, they don't even have numbers, they don't even have addresses. It's like refugee camps inside of a very modern European country for a very specific reason, because it's still a policy that the Zionists started in 48 to depress the Palestinians living in Israel as much as possible, to make them feel like that's the way it's supposed to be. Israelis, Jewish people are supposed to. On Shabbat, we all supposed to stay home. Nobody's supposed to drive a car. People do. On Kippur, we're all just forced not to. Even though I don't live a Jewish lifestyle, I'm not allowed to drive a car on Kippur. But on Ramadan, they can eat in front of me. You know what I mean? It's just that you start realizing that what black people had to go through with white people here to fight for a very basic rights, we have to go through in Palestine with Israelis.
So talk to me a little bit about how the hip hop culture has transformed Palestinian youth culture, and also women, because I know you had a hard time also,
obviously,
as a woman performing, because in some parts of the Arab world, like the Jewish world and other worlds, there's a real patriarchal system, and women are supposed to know their place and
right.
And you're out there, a very free woman, saying what you have to say and being very sensual and very, very political and doing what you do. So you also have those issues to deal with as a Palestinian woman.
Yes.
So talk about the effect that hip-hop has had on this Palestinian culture in Israel and beyond.
Really, hip-hop changed a lot inside of Palestine and even inside of Israel, because when hip hop hit the Middle East and it came to Israel and Palestine, you wouldn't believe it, but Palestinians and Israelis started singing together.
I do believe it. I have some of those albums in my car. The CDs
right.
in my car.
They started their own crew together, and as soon as the political stuff started, you know, becoming more and more obvious, the Israelis and Palestinians took you know, steps backward from each other. The Israelis became really Zionist, walking around with their, you know, David stars.
Stars of David.
Huge ones, which over there are considered pretty, like, I'm Jewish, I'm big, I'm strong. And it start intimidating a bit the Palestinian people because, you know, the Israelis have the industry. They it's their country. They control the radio stations, the TV stations. So the Israelis grew pretty fast in hip hop. It quickly became an industry. It quickly became a genre in Israel. While Palestinians making hip hop were not anymore part of that.
But despite that, Palestinian hip hop grew.
Because it had to become very underground, very very underground. It had to get very political because there was no way for Palestinian hip hop to become anything in the Israeli industry. So we had to start our own movement, our own. you know, we have to spread it around the world. If nobody's willing to support financially and, you know, give you the equipment and do everything because you're Palestinian, you're speaking of Palestinian rights, then we had to, you know, unite. We had to work together. Each person puts a bit and people grow. And it took 10 years for the first Palestinian hip-hop crew to have their first album.
And that's the crew that's coming to Baltimore.
Yes,
to the United States in October.
Yes.
And their name is?
Dem.
Dem. Mm-hmm. Dem. And they are the central group inside of Slingshot Hip-Hop.
Correct.
The film that...
They are the first Palestinian hip-hop crew and maybe the first Middle Eastern hip-hop crew too.
So, I apologize, we have to kind of end this conversation. We'll call this part one,
mm-hmm.
and then we'll pick up part two.
Wonderful.
And continue this conversation as we kind of learn about a new world of Palestinian hip-hop and the Palestinian world, and we'll find out why Abir ended up in Baltimore and who the other Palestinian hip-hop artists are, and we'll meet the woman who made the film Slingshot Hip-Hop, and eventually sometime in the fall meet the Bandam, who is center to this movement in the first Palestinian hip-hop crew.
Right.
So we'll explore this over the next few months. Abir, it's great to have you in the studios, and we'll be
Thank
talking again very soon, and we'll take you all out with a little bit of Abir's music. We'll be back.
Come on.
تقدر تعمل اللي بتعمله مش صبايا تغني وبس اللانساء اترجع للغير اصله انا صابرين الساحرة وهذا وجه الحقيقي لا بدي بيتك ولا بدي انك تيجي تنقذني وتتجوزني بدي اسمع واعمل هيب هوب شرقي فصل اباحي خليك تبطل تضحي وتضحك لما تسمع اسمي بقدر اسوي اللي بتسوي وزيادة بضعفش قبل زلمة ولا قبل اي عدل الاختلاف بيننا هالقد صغير انا اهانة لكل جنسك لي طفاني من اراء الناس انا اللي كتبت انا اللي لحنت انا الغنيت انا راح تجيب جيش بنات كمل عني اذا قتلت قبل ما تنص البيت
عيشتك السحرة
اطلع ملحقت لفترة يقفت قد ما بنات قبلت ملانة غاني كتبت ثورة جديدة خلقت صوتي بكتر احلامي في دي صار كتاب خطط كيف اخلي المنصة شايفك تحلم فيه اليوم يمكن انا مش لقيدي والشباب بهربوا بدل ما يوقعوا بحبي بس انا مسؤولة عحالي واللي بده اياني كيف ما انا بده يحبني
عيشتك السحرة
عن تم حيومي واطلعي اذا الكل وقف ضدك اذا انت ما تحركتش ما حد رح يسأل عنك فهم انه صعب كنتوا لستني هناك وعت وخبتي فرقي بين هدف هدو هداك واذا تعبت تضايقش ع غيرك في كتار هون عن حق هون مش متنزلات
Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Brad Kolodner, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.